All right, guys. Hi, this is Dr. Erin Stare. Some of you know me as Dr. Eeks, I know, from bloomingwellness.com. Here we are. It's another episode of Causes or Cures. Ivermectin. So everybody is talking about ivermectin. As you can imagine, social media is full of all sorts of stuff, truths and half-truths, but that's just sort of the nature of the democratic sharing of information, isn't it? It's messy. It's messy. Sometimes it's hard to know what's true and what's not, but that is, that's how it is. That's how the cookie crumbles. But the story of ivermectin related to COVID-19 is really interesting, and it's getting more and more interesting as time goes on. There may be some big developments very, very soon. I think today is, I don't know, what is it, February 24th? Even right when I post this, the story could change. To talk to me, though, about it is Dr. Pierre Corey. He is going to join me today on Causes or Cures. He is a pulmonologist, an expert in critical care medicine. He's highly published. He's known for inventing certain techniques and protocols in medicine. He's the president of the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance, which is a not-for-profit group that many well-respected physicians are a part of, and they're all experts in critical care. Now, you might know of Dr. Corey because he was in a video that went viral that got millions of views. It was his testimony. He testified in front of the Senate Homeland Security Committee on ivermectin, and that video went viral. And also in January, he testified to a group that's part of the NIH. And after that, the NIH removed their recommendation against using ivermectin, which is a significant development, and he's going to talk more about that. I will also include his bio, of course, in the podcast description and also on my website. And I will link to his website so you can learn more about him. But let's just jump in and start talking about ivermectin. And I want to remind you guys that this podcast is not any kind of medical advice. This is information only. It's for curious minds. It's for having conversations with smart, interesting people. So here we go. I'm super excited to talk to you. A lot of people, like, not in the mainstream, but like really, really smart people, they're all like, ivermectin's the next big story. And of course I'm like, well, yeah, but you have to be so careful what you say today. And, but I'm very curious. Like I just like to hear from smart people and learn and let people, you know, speak. Kind of why I do this podcast. And, I don't know why everyone kind of has to feel like they're walking on eggshells all the time, but anyhow. Oh,
it's a strange time. It's a strange time.
Yeah, a little bit. So I figured to start, just so they know that you're not just someone coming in off the street to do this, could you give a brief description of who you are and the kind of work you do?
Yeah. So I'm, obviously my name is Pierre Corey, and I am a pulmonary and critical care specialist from New York, trained there in a number of hospitals in Manhattan. And then I helped run an ICU there for about 10 years. I was a program director of a fellowship training program. And then I recruited to University of Wisconsin, where I spent the last 5 years. I'm no longer there, but I was the chief of the critical care service, as well as the medical director of their trauma and life support center. That's sort of where my career has taken me. You know, my expertise is obviously in critical care, also a number of aspects of pulmonary. And then what I'm probably most known for, at least pre-COVID, was I'm one of the pioneers of what's called critical care ultrasonography. You know, I was one of the first to start courses with my mentor, and I went around the country for years teaching many, many people all around the country how to use ultrasound at the bedside to make critical care diagnoses. And I have a textbook that's now in its second edition and seventh language. So a really popular textbook that I wrote with a couple of colleagues. And So, those are kind of my claims to fame.
Now, tell me about the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance.
Yeah, so that really starts with Dr. Paul Marek. So he's, you know, my friend, my mentor. He's kind of a mentor to all of us in the group. You know, my research and his overlapped a few years ago. And so we got to talking about a few things we were working on and just became kind of fast friends and very close colleagues. And he's like a world famous doctor. He's the second most published doctor in our specialty. He's written, you know, 500 or 50 book chapters or something crazy like that. So he's very, very well known as a thought leader in the specialty. And basically, the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance came together early on in the pandemic when some doctors reached out to Dr. Marek and said, you know, this thing's coming. We saw what was happening in Italy. New York was starting to get hit. And people said, you know, Dr. Marek, you got to come up with a protocol because he's famous for some of his treatment protocols. Mm-hmm. And so he pulled us five together and some other doctors gave us a little bit of structure. We started doing Zoom meetings and we just kind of worked out our strategies, learning at the bedside, reading everything and talking to everyone. You know, mm-hmm. Since I was in New York for so long, I knew the ICU director of almost every ICU in New York City. And when they were drowning, I was on the phone with my closest colleagues there every day, you know, finding out what was working, what wasn't. And we were all doing that. Umberto Maduri, who's also a world famous doctor in our group, he was talking to his colleagues from Italy. And that's sort of what we've done. And in along that path through the pandemic, we came up with two major treatment protocols. One is called Math Plus for the hospital, and that's really for the sicker of the sick, or really the hospitalized patient. And then in the fall, we came up with an early treatment protocol, and that was largely put out after we identified the data behind ivermectin. We had not had ivermectin in our treatment protocols throughout the pandemic, but in October, we were reviewing like this whole slew of trials that were coming out, published, pre-published on all of these therapeutics that were negative. They were failing, like all the solo tocilizumab ones. You know, remdesivir is very unsatisfying to negative. Monoclonal antibodies, convalescent plasma, nothing was really showing big impacts in this disease. Actually, the one thing that I without ego here, what we try to remind folks is that the FLCCC Alliance, I actually gave testimony in the Senate back in May. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I recommended rather loudly, as is my fashion, mm-hmm. that it was critical we use corticosteroids in this disease and that it was life-saving and you had to do it. And that was at a time where the entire world, every major public health institution in this country and around the world was adamant that corticosteroids should not be used. And so I got kind of attacked and criticized for that for many weeks until the Oxford trial came out, which basically proved that it was life-saving to use corticosteroids. So we were validated with our first protocol. And now we're kind of on the same, we're just on the same path with ivermectin. That's probably a long answer, but you asked how we came about and that's sort of our story. And then our story just gets really kind of big.
Okay.
since ivermectin.
Okay. So not everybody who listens to this podcast has a medical or scientific background, but everyone is really, really interested in this pandemic and treatments because they're worried. So can you just explain, you know, what is ivermectin and how did this even come on people's radar? Like, hey, this might help, you know, people who have COVID-19.
Yeah. So ivermectin is one of history's most important medications. It's so important. It's an anti-parasite. So it's mostly known for its effects on parasites and eradicating parasites, not only in humans, but in livestock and animals and dogs and cats. And so it's like one of the most widely used medicines in the world. It's already won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for its impacts in eradicating the scourge of parasitic diseases across many continents. It's also on the WHO's list of essential medicines. So this is fascinatingly powerful and safe drug. And that's kind of why it's had such impact. It's remarkably safe, safer than aspirin, safer than Tylenol, some of the more common medicines that we use. And so what happened with COVID is that, and now I'm kind of an expert at ivermectin, but around 2012, so almost 10 years ago, there was some laboratory studies showing Ivermectin was prohibiting or stopping the growth of viruses in cell cultures. And there was a number of viral models, like people have heard of Zika and dengue and West Nile and even HIV and influenza. And so there's all these little experiments showing that in cell cultures, ivermectin was really effective. Now, for the doctors and the non-doctors on your podcast, for a medicine to make the leap from the bench to the bedside, as we call it, from the lab to actually being effective in humans, is a really long leap. And most medicines, in fact, the vast majority of medicines, never make that. So just because it worked in an experiment doesn't mean it works in real life. But in April, a group from Australia, from Monash University in Australia, published the first study using a SARS-CoV-2 model, so a COVID viral model, and they showed like complete eradication of the virus in their model when they exposed it to ivermectin. And so that got a lot of attention. So that's already been a lot of people looked at. In fact, Peru, which is a whole other crazy story I could talk about for an hour, but Peru, unique amongst the world, their federal health ministry, because they were getting hammered with cases and deaths, they made the decision that based on that cell culture model, they incorporated it into their national health guideline. That was not without controversy because it was a really bold step. But I got to tell you, I think it was an amazing thing to do because it's such a safe medicine. Clearly, they didn't know if it was going to work in humans, but they wanted to throw something at this pandemic. And they alone, amongst all countries, actually, a couple other South American countries did that back then. So that's sort of chapter one. So that's the little history of its work on viruses. Then it showed to work. Maybe it worked in COVID-19, but we didn't have like what's called clinical trials data. We didn't have like, tests on humans. It just started to be used. Even in this country, people were using it. And in fact, one doctor, Dr. Ryder, down in Broward County in Florida, he started using it in March, April, and he actually finally published his paper in September in a major medical journal, Chest, where he, after analyzing all the patients who got ivermectin and didn't during those months, he saw this phenomenal difference in mortality. And so his was one of the first papers where everyone started to say, hey, maybe this thing is working. And the last sentence I'll say is from right before his trial to ever since, all we have is every week this increasing number of trials all showing the same results, which is either a huge statistically significant impact on the time to viral clearance, the time to clinical recovery, or survival. And so you're seeing these reproducible studies, but they're from all over the world. Many of them are what are some people kind of dismiss as small, but we can talk about what small is. But they're from many different centers around the world, and there's an increasing number. And so now we're at the point where we had like the rationale and the science, basic science data. Now we're just drowning in clinical data showing that it's effective.
Okay, and that's so. I'm gonna walk through this timeline, and you can tell me if it's correct. So you guys testified, you and some of your colleagues testified to the in front of the NIH treatment guidelines panel in either like late December, January.
Yeah, January 6th.
Okay, January 6th. So after that, they removed their recommendation that said
Against, yeah.
against, right? Move their recommendation against or their recommendation to not use ivermectin. They said, okay, there's something here. And that means now, like doctors can decide, basically, working with their patients one on one. This gives it the same kind of status, I guess, as the monoclonal antibodies, I think.
Yeah. And convalescent plasma. They all have that
Okay.
similar, like, it might
Maybe.
work, it might not. The data doesn't tell us which. At least that's their opinion. You might, Dr. Stair, you might know that that's not our opinion.
No, I know.
We thought the data was convincing.
I read. I read their letter and your response, and that's kind of so that's going to just lead me into the next question. Like, the randomized controlled trials, which people say these are the gold standards, and we know that all trials vary, right, depending on how well they're funded and the methodology. So let's just like how many randomized controlled trials, we'll just start there, have been conducted so far on ivermectin and COVID-19 patients?
So, two-part answer. One is there's the WHO, after my testimony in the Senate, or actually just before then, after our manuscript got first posted on a preprint server and it started getting more attention, because I think we were the first group to kind of compile the evidence in a credible and organized mm-hmm. fashion and really actually come to a conclusion that this should be standard of care. We came to a very early conclusion that this should be standard of care, way too fast for most people. But after that, ivermectin got attention and the WHO assigned a team that was looking at repurposed drugs ever since June. They looked at like six different repurposed drugs. None of them were working out. They're all showing either no effect or mixed effects. And then they started to look at ivermectin. And what happened to that team and what happened to us is the same. We both got really impressed with the data signal. And the WHO assigned them this task: identify all randomized controlled trials of ivermectin in the world and accumulate and compile the results. So the answer is there's 56 registered randomized controlled trials of ivermectin treatment in COVID-19. I'm going to leave alone the prophylaxis trials for a second. Just on treatment, there's 56. Okay. Right now, as of today, it's kind of a moving target because data is coming out so fast, but it's around 22 to 23 results from 22 to 23 randomized control trial results are known currently. And it's approaching about 3,000 patients in those trials, which is a really substantive amount of data.
Right, right. And just for people who don't know, like prophylactic, you mean taking preventive, right?
Okay. Preventive, yeah. So treatment is when you get sick and take it to get better. Right. Prevention is when you take it so you don't get it.
Okay.
Right? Or prophylactic is. So yeah, I keep telling myself to use the word prevention instead of prophylactic.
Okay. I work in health communications, and you learn it's like a game to try to simplify things like further and further and further.
I've always thought that I do a reasonably good job, and I always try to pay a lot of attention to that. But the prophylaxis thing is the thing that keeps tripping me up.
It's okay. So let's get back to the sample size. Like in one of the criticisms, so to speak, was that, oh, well, the sample size is not big enough. They need like a one trial with thousands of people to really detect this difference. How do you respond to that?
So simply. And remember, Dr. Stare, you reminded me your audience is not all physicians. So, but I'm going to have to go into a little statistics here. What they're talking about is, in general, it's assumed that you need large trials in order to really accurately detect a true difference between a therapy and a placebo, right? Mm-hmm. But what they're forgetting is the concept of statistical power is actually driven by two main variables. One is the size of the trial. The other one is the size of the treatment effect. So if you have something that's really potent, that works really well, you don't need thousands and thousands of patients. Now, a lot of pharmaceutical drugs, like for instance, statin or aspirin for heart attack, you know, they really do help, but the impacts are actually small, and the numbers needed to treat to make a huge difference is sometimes 50 to 60 to 80, right? Mm-hmm. So when you have a treatment effect that small, you really do need trials of thousands of patients. Mm. The treatment effect of ivermectin is so large that we are detecting reproducible, statistically significant benefits in smaller trials than those in the thousands. So a couple of hundred, 300, 500. Every randomized controlled trial over 100 patients has shown a statistically significant result. And it's reproducible from different countries and centers around the world, which is nearly impossible in modern medicine to have reproducible results from all of these trials. Sure. And then the last thing that I'm going to say, this is, again, maybe more to the doctor, but, and this is what gets me like almost angry, is when people forget that the strongest form of medical evidence is not actually a single large randomized controlled trial. It's actually what's called a meta-analysis of numerous randomized controlled trials. So it's when you synthesize data from many, many different experiments. And if the signal is true and consistent among all, that's the strongest signal you can have. And so when the NIH dismisses a pile of 21, or at the time we presented to them 17, a pile of 17 randomized controlled trials with a cumulative 2,100 patients with these reproducible, statistically significant outcomes, and they say we need a large trial, do you get my frustration? Because it's just wrong. It's just wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I understand. That said,
there are larger trials underway. Is that correct? Like in Mexico?
So Mexico has a 3,000 person trial, but here's the kicker. It's not randomized. It's actually a large kind of observational trial where they're trying different doses, but it's large. So the WHO is going to look at that one because it's such a big pile of data.
Right.
And they do have a comparison group. It's just not a randomized comparison group. So it's kind of just like patients treated before or during who didn't get ivermectin. But that is a very large trial. It's just not randomized. So they'll dismiss that there because there's this thing in medicine that's been happening over the last 10, 20 years. It's something I call randomized controlled trial fundamentalism. It's like this belief that that's the only thing that is true and is the only thing that brings truth. And I have to tell you, I would like to make a difference. Again, I don't want to make this too scientific, but a randomized controlled trial in a lab and an experiment is automatic and any other is inapplicable. But when you go into the real world, in the clinical world, where there's so many randomized controlled trials, they can be very good, but some of them can really actually lead you astray and not capture the true treatment effect because of a different timing or dose. And so sometimes you're led to conclusions that are wrong and it becomes a real big challenge in the clinical world. Okay. Did I answer that question about the size? Yeah. I think I answered your question, right? Trials that are coming. So yeah, Mexico. And then there's a 500 person trial in Argentina. There's another 400 in Brazil coming out. So basically what I'll tell you is this: in the meta-analysis, it is anticipated by mid-March, the collection of data will be approximately 29 controlled trials with over 4,000 patients.
Okay. That seems like a good number to me. But
and we believe, and the WHO seems to suggest that at that point, they will have finished their review or sometime shortly after that, and they will come to a recommendation.
Right. And I have a question about that down the line here. The one thing I also wanted to ask you about, which was this, another criticism was that, well, some of these trials were not blinded, meaning patients.
Oh my God. Sorry.
Okay. I'm like, all right, please don't have a heart attack.
No. it's just my lame attempts at humor. Sorry.
But when I thought the rebuttal made perfect, you guys had objective measures, meaning like those are things that people can't, no matter how much, you know, power the mind has over the body, like you can't change those, right?
No. Yeah. So if you don't have a blinded trial and you rely on things like subjective reporting of symptoms, yeah, that can be influenced. Because if someone knows they got the drug and someone got the placebo, they may be more likely to report an effect versus not. Right. So, yeah, we know those are kind of subjective measures, but objective ones where you're actually doing PCR swabs, like it's very, we believe, call us crazy, that it's nearly impossible to affect the positivity or negativity of your PCR swab if you know what one you're in. So that's more of an objective measure. Death is actually considered an objective measure. And so like those are just, you're either dead or you're not. It's not something that you report.
Yeah.
You either find you dead. And I don't want to get too morbid, but you know, death and like viral cultures and PCR tests, they're objective. And so they're not, they shouldn't be negatively or have a bias depending on the design of the trial. And then the last thing, and I'm probably going to repeat myself, is what's remarkable about this evidence base is that there's at least 5 or 6, now 7, double-blind randomized controlled trials. One of them is even triple-blinded. Then there's single-blinded, and then there's open-label randomized controlled trials. They all show the same thing.
Right, and so double, can you just explain double-blind?
The double-blind is where the person who's running the trial, like the doctor who's overseeing the trial, they don't know who is getting placebo or not. So like the pill is, you know, looks white in both and it comes in a package and you have no idea who's actually getting what. So the way you follow them, the way you treat them, the way you assess them, you have no idea who you're treating. So that's the investigator's blind. And then the double is when the patient has no idea whether they got the pill or not. They had just given a pill. It could be the treatment. It might be the placebo. So that's where when both sides are blind, that's considered the most accurate and least corruptible or, you know, the least biased form of a trial.
Right. Okay. Can you talk a little bit about the dosing riddle?
Yeah.
Okay. Because yeah. I've read so stuff.
We've been swimming in that real. So Paul okay. Marrick and I have, you know, had just numerous conversations. And one of the things that we've always said about our protocols, the both protocols, which are on our website, right, which is flccc.net, is they're in evolution. You know, we follow the data, we follow the science, and if we find new actionable data or information that we think should influence how we treat, we'll change it. And we have changed our dosing strategy a couple of times as we've learned more and as more data has come out. I won't want to talk about what the first ones were, but the ones that we're on now and our protocols are on there. And just so you know, for ivermectin, at least as an outpatient, we have three protocols. One is for prevention of getting the disease, if you're a high-risk individual, older comorbidities. You know, we have one where you take it every 2 weeks. Then we have one where if you have an exposure to a COVID patient, so particularly in households, if someone comes home, brings home COVID, there's five other household members, right. There's really good data showing that if you give a couple of doses over 2 days, separated by a day, you really protect the household from getting sick. And then we have treatment. So outpatient treatment, we have a minimum of 2 days. So we're now doing daily. So daily dose, minimum of 2, maximum of 5, and stop when you feel better. Because we're seeing so many patients actually, especially if you treat them early, they're feeling better within 24, 36, 48 hours. So don't always need the 5 days. But anyway, we do daily for treatment. And then we have different frequencies for the prophylaxis.
Okay. And now, in terms of safety, is there like, can you take too much? Like, is something going to happen to someone who takes too much?
So the safety of ivermectin is it's literally unparalleled. So 4 billion doses have been given in humans. Safety data has been compiled in databases since like 1992. It has one of the fewest reports of adverse effects over that time period, over almost any medicine, especially in the pandemic, comparing other medicine pandemic, it still doesn't have as much as those other ones do. So it's extremely safe. It's even safer than aspirin or Tylenol, which have been around for longer. You know, the side effects are usually attributed to the parasite disease that's being treated. So a lot of times when you kill the parasites, there's a rash, a fever, some itching, you know, some swelling, some soreness. And that's either the disease or the medicine, but important severe side effects are almost undescribed. And what's a shame is you'll see some places with absurd amount of caution around ivermectin, which is just misplaced, that they'll say, oh, it can cause coma and seizures. There's like 20 cases in the literature over 4 billion doses where they thought ivermectin might've contributed to like a neurologic problem. Mm-hmm. I've seen people write things like, oh, watch out for your liver failure. There's no dose adjustment for liver failure, number one. And there's 2 cases of hepatitis in 4 billion doses that are published. And both of those were acute inflammation of the liver that rapidly resolved. And it's not even clear it was the ivermectin. So it really just doesn't have truly important, worrisome side effects. And then the safety of even toxic doses. So many case reports and even studies where they gave healthy volunteers like 10 times the dose. And we even overdoses where the young kids did well have been described. So it's just really hard to believe that you're adding any risk to giving ivermectin. I will say nothing's 100%, but this might be like 99.5712% safety.
Okay. And I'm going to get back to the dose dependent effect in a minute, but I wanted to ask,
I answered that. That's fair.
Wait, that's another question down the line. Don't worry. I've made them separate. how do you respond to someone who compares the ivermectin story to hydroxychloroquine?
Two ways. So, one is that, hydroxychloroquine was adopted early in the pandemic with no clinical trials data to support. It just had a rationale and a pretty good safety record, and so it was used. And it was used widely around the world. What happened after that is so much data came out around hydroxychloroquine, and a lot of it conflicted. especially some of the randomized controlled trials, and that's actually a whole other topic, is that the randomized controlled trials on hydroxychloroquine were not considered to have been like really perfectly designed. They're oftentimes in late phase patients with curious doses, and they didn't really show an effect. The observational trials, where they treated a whole bunch of people with hydroxychloroquine versus those that didn't, showed a fairly reproducible effect of benefit, mostly in outpatient and early on. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, although there's so much controversy around it, our group actually believes that hydroxychloroquine is beneficial if you give it early and at a proper dose. But that's based on like tons and tons of studies, and even more studies are coming out of it. But there was so much controversy around it, and the randomized controlled trials were negative. And so that sunk it. Because I told you, we live in an era of RCT fundamentalism. If the RCT says it doesn't work, it can't work. And that's what happened with hydroxychloroquine. So it was largely abandoned and dismissed, even though it does have a beneficial effect. So those are the two differences. It was adopted before the trials data, then trials data came out, and it caused a lot of controversy. The difference with ivermectin is that the opposite happened, is that now it's not being adopted despite huge amounts of randomized and observational trial data, which all line up and which all support use, yet they're not using it. And so if you ask why one phenomenon happened around this drug and why another happened around this drug, I think one is in relation to the other. I think everyone who adopted the medicine widely and those who are left with the feeling that it didn't work, either through their misinterpretation of the data or they just didn't feel it wouldn't work, you know, they don't want to make any more mistakes. And so there's this strong resistance to adopting anything until it's proven to work. And that's another thing that, you know, again, if I can clutch my chest, I think that conservatism is appropriate in expensive, high resource or risky medications. Those you should have a lot of conservatism before adoption. But in something as incredibly safe as ivermectin, to ask for the threshold of evidence to reach these stratospheric heights, it doesn't seem pragmatic, and it doesn't seem to be earthbound. Have you looked at the world outside? I mean, we're getting rolled by this pandemic. You have this really safe drug with such compelling evidence. I'm not even going to say compelling. It's convincing. Evidence, and yet it's still there's reluctance to being adopted.
To your point about you know, the fact that it's a very cost effective, right? It's cheap. It's I assume it's widely available. Perhaps the World Health Organization that deals with far, you know, poorer countries than the U.S. might play into their analysis, I would imagine.
Monoclonal antibodies, you know, they're not available to most of the world. Vaccines are going to be slow to get there. I mean,
And so, but that also should mean like, if it works for obviously under, you know, resourced people, it still works. It's just.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I read, Dr. Hill, he's on your team. Is he part of your organization?
No, not at all. Just a colleague.
He's a colleague.
Because we have shared now rapidly shared expertise. He was not an ivermectin expert before November. We were not ivermectin experts before October. We've been, you know, it's part of our jobs. He gets paid. We're just an advocacy, you know, a nonprofit humanitarian organization. We're just interested in developing the best treatment protocols possible. But he doesn't have, none of us have a conflict of interest around it. We just have a deep shared interest in getting the right answer and making that right answer known to the world to try to help solve the pandemic. And so so we discuss, you know, we've had insights, we've had dosing discussions together. He's been helpful at his insights, and he's actually a pharmacologist a PhD in pharmacology. And so he's been a good colleague. And now I will say we were way ahead of him in the data. Now he's surpassed us because he has a full team that works around the clock, and he has a direct contact with all of the trial investigators around the world. He has access to data before it comes out on preprints and before it's published. And so, he's now way ahead of us.
But he has a meta-analysis that's in preprint right now, right?
Yeah, that one has 17 trials, but like I said, he's adding to them every day. So that was what was called the preliminary one. And because they knew more trials were coming and they, I don't know, there's this cautiousness around everyone. They tried to say that that's preliminary and they didn't want anyone to, you know, make too much of it. So they had very soft language in the conclusions of that manuscript, but the results, the data in that manuscript are profoundly positive.
Yeah, I thought that too. I thought, I agree that I think, though, having a cautious conclusion is sort of part of, I don't know, the era we live in, maybe.
We weren't there in March and April. We did, you know, did some bold things. You know, we adopted hydroxychloroquine EUA, convalescent plasma EUA with no data, monoclonal antibodies with really weak data. So maybe here we have... I don't know. It seems to be selective cautiousness, Aaron. Okay. I don't know. I don't want to get too conspiratorial, but it's. I don't know. I'm coming up with reasons why it's so selective.
Well, no, I think people do wonder that. I mean, I looked at, I read the studies you put out. I read your protocols, and then I read his study. I guess it's being peer reviewed too.
Yes.
Which is a whole other topic, right? But yep. it showed. Similarly, 75% reduction in mortality, very statistically significant. And I was like, wow, like that's a powerful number.
I got to tell you, a 75% absolute reduction in mortality is if you look at the history of medicines that we have,
right?
That would put it in like the top three or four most powerful medicines known to man. So for instance, the one that I quote, the most powerful therapy we have in medicine is actually defibrillating someone in ventricular fibrillation or shock. When you do that, you know, you shock them for refib. That has what's called the number needed to treat to save a life of about 2.5. So every time you try to shock someone out of VFib with a paddle, you'll save a life every 2.5 times you do it. For an absolute risk reduction of 75%, that means that every four patients you treat, you're going to save a life. And no one needs to treat a four.
And talk about. Also, there was a dose-dependent effect. Can we go back to that?
Yeah. So that was really, that came out of Andy Hill's work, Dr. Hill, because we just didn't have the granularity of data that he does. You know, we were working off of preprints and peer-reviewed, and some of the data and how they were presented were not only not as comprehensive as we would have liked, some of it was missing, but when he started to look at, in particular, the outcome of time to viral clearance, he noticed that if you look at the studies that had one dose of ivermectin, I think there was about five studies, or maybe six, four of those six did show a statistically significant reduction in the time to viral clearance with one dose of ivermectin. When he looked at the collection of trials with multiple day dosing, anywhere from 2 to 5 day dosing, every single result was statistically significant and the time duration extended. Like you'd have like 6 to 12 days. Like some people would clear after 6, the control or placebo would do it after 12. And so it really seemed to, and there's also a couple other little studies which also showed within their studies a dose dependent response. And that's like a physiologic scientific finding that's like another pillar of support that something's actually working as an antiviral.
And then his conclusion, like you said, was more conservative.
Very.
We need higher quality, larger scale clinical trials for regulatory approval. But it was also sort of like, but look at this. There's something here.
Yeah, it was. It's very discordant. I think. I think it was. Again, I don't know why it was so cautious. I think they just. I think they just didn't want people overreacting to the results. Out of caution. Let's call it that's the most benign reason, is excess caution. But the other relatively benign reason is that at the time he was only beginning to collect all of the data you need to assign a quality the quality grade to each trial. Right. When you look at trials, they're designed in certain ways and you look for certain aspects of their design to be a high quality versus a low quality. And so he was just beginning to grade the quality of the studies. And so and I'll tell you, the grade of the quality of studies is pretty good. The last I heard from a couple of different teams of experts, it's either low to moderate or moderate. And I got to tell you, almost all of medicine sits on a moderate degree of evidence. It's very rare that you have a high level degree of evidence. Moderate is what corticosteroids has. And that's the worldwide standard of treatment in moderate to severe COVID. And that has a moderate quality of evidence. And it's the worldwide standard.
You know, I can't help but notice, like, a lot of these studies you're quoting are from different countries. Are there any studies at all? I mean, we're a pretty wealthy country here in the U.S.
You're like stepping on all the landmines, aren't you? as a former military
officer, okay.
Maybe you like doing that. I don't know.
I'm curious. I just like to know things and I'm a soldier.
So do I. I want to know things. So maybe you can explain to me. So here's here's my best explanation. So I think our government went in hyper focus with Operation Warp Speed. And we would have to agree that so far that seems to be a resounding success. You know, with the development of these vaccines, and they apparently are starting to make a significant dent. And I hope that continues, and I hope they have long-term efficacy and safety. But it was really a big push towards the vaccines. I know there were some discussions of looking at repurposed drugs. If you've heard my opinion in other parts, I think that was insufficient. But there is now a sustained attention to doing trials on repurposed drugs. Oxford did corticosteroids. That was a repurposed drug. Mm-hmm. But why was an ivermectin chosen? I don't know. I mean, they chose some others. They didn't. Maybe it was luck of the draw. I also find really curious why ivermectin alone, out of any proposed therapeutic, is the only one to have received a recommendation against use out of a trial.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Remember, you brought it up early on that when the NIH changed their recommendation in January after we presented to them, it was sitting on a recommendation against use out of a trial, and then they made it to more of that neutral one. Right. But it sat on that recommendation for many months. And I still wonder, and I asked the panel this, and I didn't really get a clear answer. I said, why did ivermectin, one of the world's safest drugs, get such a strong recommendation against use? I just can't figure out why you would do that in a pandemic. And I don't know. And I don't know why trials weren't done. I think that's going to come in the reckoning. Now, those are questions that many will ask. How come the U.S. wasn't leading research into repurposed drugs like ivermectin? And you know what? It's going to be the developing world that saves us. You know, Bangladesh and India and Nigeria, and now Israel. Actually, Israel just did a trial last week, a really well done trial, which was profoundly positive. You know, Brazil, Argentina, Mexico. So you have all of these, and even some in Africa. And so you have all of these other countries outside of the developed world that did all these trials. And I don't know why the government didn't choose. You'd have to ask them. There are three trials. I'll tell you this. There are three trials that were approved in this country, and they've been going on for a while. They've just been very slow to start and very slow to recruit. I've talked to two of the three investigators, and one just went through insane amounts of red tape with IRB and all sorts of discussions, and they made them get what's called an IND, and it gets complicated, but it was insanely bureaucratic. And I think now they're starting to recruit. So I don't know. I call it a day late, dollar short, there are trials ongoing.
Okay. So I guess have you faced like any kind of, I mean, you faced a lot of personal backlash. Did you?
Yeah, that's an understatement.
Well, I was going to let you describe that if you wanted to, but I
so am dead to that all now. It's just, It's just, yeah, I mean, so I've lost two jobs in the pandemic. The first one I didn't lose, I actually left. That one was easy. I was having a lot of, I would say, professional disagreements with my superiors. I just refused to be a leader in critical care in a pandemic where I was being told I had to use supportive care only, which is like water, oxygen, Tylenol. And I wanted to treat the hypercoagulability with blood thinners. I wanted to treat the inflammation with steroids. I wanted to avoid automatic intubation. And it just seemed like everything that I proposed and all the evidence that I showed for doing it was insufficient. Everything I do and say, I'm always told my evidence is insufficient. So it's kind of like a trigger word. And so
I will not use it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, don't say insufficient evidence. But... you know, and I just got so frustrated, and that actually was kind of a pinnacle of my entire 5 years in what I call the ivory tower. And I said to my wife, who's actually also a pulmonary critical care physician, who actually is a partner of mine, or was, she still works at the university. And I just said there, and she knew I've been trying to be a critical care leader there. And just, I just said, you know, I think I'm done. I can't do this. And so I jumped out of the ivory tower. So that was job one. That was voluntary. And that was great, because I actually went to New York and I worked there, helped out my old colleagues who were just dying of like fatigue and burnout from the surge. And so I got to like whatever ground zero, and I was just happy to help. And that was a really sad and just totally demoralizing time. But then the second one that was just pretty, I'll just keep that short and simple. You know, I gave testimony in the Senate. It went viral. And I don't think institutions like when your opinions go viral, because then they have to fight off that it's not their opinions and whatever. And so they basically wanted me to like never talk to the press unless I checked with them first on everything. And they just gave me like a lot of restrictions on my First Amendment rights. And it was a pretty short conversation. I just said, no, thank you.
I've noticed the same trend very much so. And without going into specifics, I do, I am concerned about that trend, because I do feel that doctors like yourself who've been in the trenches, have research, treating patients, like we want to hear from people like you.
Here's the difference. Yeah. Let me say the difference, because I wouldn't say I'm an expert at this, but I've had to work with a few lawyers at this point. Mm. So what's interesting is when I was at the university, which is a public institution, and I'm actually a faculty member, you know, I was an associate professor there. Actually, one of your core responsibilities in society as a professor is actually to advocate and share knowledge. You are supposed to speak publicly. You are supposed to speak in front of government bodies when asked. It's like, it's actually like one of the, you know, one of your core, I think, moral or, you know, academic responsibilities. However, when you do that, some universities really don't like it. The University of Wisconsin, historically, I've been told, has been unique in actually supporting their faculty members' rights to speak out and speak publicly. In my case, I didn't feel I was so supported, not at all. Yeah. But I've heard that they've behaved much, much better in other cases. So without talking about them anymore, although I was supposed to be supported in my advocacy then, you know, that's a public institution, that's a university. My most recent employer is private. And they can determine, you know, they can restrict your behavior. So they basically effectively tore up my old contract and said, you want to keep working here? Here's your new one. And I said, I don't like that one. And so bye.
That's a topic for another podcast, but it's something that really concerns me, because I think we should be able to, especially in America, have these conversations. People are going to disagree on things. People are going to have different opinions, but as long as we express them respectfully and we're like, hey, well, what about this? Or like, I don't know. I don't like that trend. I think it's concerning.
I think the laws protect private enterprises in restricting their employees and how they behave, even outside of work. You know, I said, listen, you're preventing me from being a physician in society. You know, it's not like I was advocating while at work or doing anything like that. And I didn't have to use their name with anything, but, you know, anyway.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. So I guess I want to thank you for your time. This was very informative. Yes, and I appreciate you sharing your expertise and what you're doing and your story. And it is an amazing story. Like, I think when we look back in history, it'll be like, wow, like, you know. So I guess in the next couple of months here, you mentioned the World Health Organization is taking a closer look at ivermectin. What do you think is going to happen here? Like in the next couple
of
months?
How about this? Let's talk about today.
Okay.
because I think a major event just happened in the last 3 days. And I think the importance and significance of this event, I am really interested to see what plays out over the next week or two worldwide. So real briefly, what happened this weekend is a group in the UK formulated what they called the British Ivermectin Recommendation Development Committee. And they had like a planning meeting a month ago where they started to put together their protocol for doing a systematic review and meta-analysis, just like the WHO and Andrew Hill. So they kind of do the same work. In fact, it's coordinated by a group that has worked for the WHO for many years, but they're independent. All they did was coordinate this effort. And this weekend, they brought together, I think it was like 7 or 8 steering committee members with 65 participants around the world. And they presented the evidence and they followed the same guidelines and process that the WHO and other large regulatory agencies follow in determining whether to recommend a treatment. And so the 65 attendees were a diverse array of clinicians, specialists, researchers, even patient representatives. And this group coordinated it and they listened to the evidence. The evidence was graded and then they made their recommendations. And this document is unbelievably powerful because it actually covers all the regions that the WHO does. There was representation from all the continents and many countries. And they arrived at a very strong recommendation or a strong recommendation for use of ivermectin in the prevention and treatment of COVID-19.
Wow.
And that document, again, that was an independent nonprofit effort. So it was not funded or supported by anyone. And it was voluntary by all the invitees. And, you know, there were some general practitioners from the UK that were invited who didn't really know about ivermectin. And so it was a diverse array of people. And they came to a strong recommendation for use. And so that document I know is being sent to WHO. It's going to be sent to the NHS in the UK. It's going to be sent to the NIH, even the Canadians. And so you asked about what's going to happen the WHO in 4 to 6 weeks. Let's see what happens this week. I'm really interested to see what kind of traction this document gets. I would like to see if the major media will actually pick up and write about ivermectin. That's the other problem is there's been just very little appetite for major media outlets to write about a drug that's quote unquote not approved, even though it's, you know, has that neutral recommendation. They can write about monoclonal antibodies all they want, but they apparently don't write about ivermectin. But I don't know if you could detect a resentment there, but
slight.
Yeah, there you go. But, you know, so I'm hoping that, you know, that was a really credible, admirable effort by a bunch of scientists, researchers, and clinicians from around the world who independently assessed this evidence and came to a consensus decision. And it was a very strong decision. And so I think it's an example model for similar regulatory agencies to find the same. And I hope they do so quickly.
Right. And we might see a change in the recommendation here in the States. Like that could very well happen.
Here's my belief, and I'm going to go with a brave believing this, is that ivermectin will be the standard of care in COVID-19 around the world. The only question I have is when. And I'm so tired of answering when. I just hope it's soon. But it's definitely never going to be as soon as I think it should be. But it will happen. The data is unmistakable and undeniable.
All right. Well, Dr. Corey, I want to thank you so much for your time. And I look forward to seeing what happens here with ivermectin. And my listeners, they're all very curious, kind of like me. So,
well, no, your questions were great. And
thank
you did your homework. So I appreciate
it. I do my homework. Well, I've been so frustrated by like, just, I always feel like I can't get the information. So like my mom always said, she's like, Aaron, go to the horse's mouth. So that's what I've been doing with this podcast. Cause I'm just like, why are people being censored? Why are videos being taken down? Like, I've gotten people, they'll be like, Aaron, I'd love to come on your podcast, but my institution won't let me. And then they refer me to somebody else who thinks like them. Yeah, like I just, and like you, and like, I think like you, and I'm like, what, you guys are scholars? Like, your job is to talk to the public. Like, we want you to talk. Like, we don't want-
Yeah, it makes us almost like spies, right? Like
100%. And I-
It's weird.
And I just-
Censorship doesn't work. It never has. And I can't believe we have to relearn that lesson now. I'm actually getting texted. I have another meeting right now.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciated this.
Yeah. So it's too bad I couldn't see your face. You're in the dark. But anyway, it's nice to meet you.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
All right, guys, I want to thank you so much for listening to this episode of Causes or Cures. I hope you learned something. I hope you share the episode. I hope you subscribe and become a listener. And if you can review the podcast, I need more reviews. I know it's like not high tech and I don't have a lot of bells and whistles in this podcast, but if you like it, please review it. Well, I guess if you don't like it, review it too, so I can learn from the bad reviews. Anyhow, a special thank you again to Dr. Corey for coming on and sharing his expertise with us. I learned something. I hope you guys learned something. I will also share his website that includes the protocols he talked about that involve ivermectin. You should know that they're out there. It's publicly available information. And you should also know where the approval on ivermectin stands, which we talked about in the podcast. But it's a cool story, isn't it? The ivermectin story, and it's ever evolving, even as I record this, which is cool to think about. I did get a little heated there, passionate about censorship. I am passionate about that issue, and I know many people don't agree with me, but on my YouTube channel, I hope to make the case for why I believe censorship doesn't work and it ultimately backfires. So stay tuned for that on my YouTube channel. At the same time, I acknowledge that it is a difficult situation, a complex problem. We have the abyss that is social media, where anyone can post anything anywhere and things can go viral. So the question is how do you handle misinformation? And how do you, tweeze that out from people who are offering different perspectives or sharing things based on their experience, based on their expertise. I think with censorship, there's this problem, this dangerous slippery slope from banning misinformation, what fact checkers, and I don't know who they are, but what fact checkers deem as misinformation versus, slipping to banning criticism, genuine criticism or dissent for things that are happening there. And in America, I firmly believe, especially as the power of social media continues to grow, that's the way we communicate. There needs to be avenues for people to express concerns, dissent, criticism. That's who we are as Americans. And it is a problem that is messy, and we need to figure out how to deal with it. But I don't think telling people to shut up is the answer, or taking videos down or removing books. I really, really do not believe the answer. And I know full well that many very well-respected people disagree with me, and I'm willing to have that conversation, maybe a debate or something, a future podcast debate. That said, all right, guys, thanks so much for tuning in. I have to get some coffee and walk my dog here. It's early in New York City. Maybe you hear the trucks rumbling by in the background on Third Avenue. Yeah, you don't hear birds. Maybe I should move to the country. You'd wake up, you'd hear birds with your morning coffee instead of the garbage trucks, the millions of garbage trucks. All right, but I digress. Take care, guys. Stay healthy and have a great day. Bye.